at dealing with the human rights or recognizing the human rights of Indigenous peoples is kind of a foundational step in respecting the rights and freedoms of all members of our society. And this panel has been particularly asked to focus on the ways in which various states have addressed through their legal systems, their policies and other initiatives to address both past injustices as a result of colonial histories, as well as the ways to address future issues of Indigenous peoples living in diverse communities. So I'd like to welcome our three panellists. To my right is the Honourable Sir Edward Dury, who has a very distinguished career as a judge and Chief Justice of the Maori Land Court, as a commissioner on the Waitangi Tribunal in New Zealand, and as a judge of the New Zealand High Court, and also a law commissioner of the New Zealand Law Commission. He's come a long way to be with us, so I'm very glad you could make it to join us here today. We also have Mr. Kenneth Deer, who is a Mohawk from the closest Mohawk community to Montreal. He has a range of different expertises that he brings to the table here today, and notably in media and communications as the former editor of his community, Ganawagi, the Ganawagi newspaper, and also a lot of experience in education and particularly with respect to the development of the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. So welcome, Kenneth. And lastly, we have Professor Isabel Altamirano Jimenez, who comes to us from the University of Alberta. She's an Indigenous Zapotec from southern Mexico and has particular interests in issues concerning Indigenous women, globalization, nationalism, and we were just talking briefly about some of the tensions that that tend to be created between communal or collective Indigenous rights and individual rights that that women might want to claim. So welcome. The proceedings for this session will be that each of our speakers have 15 minutes to just briefly tell us, present some of their ideas to us. The main point, I think, of bringing us all together is so that we can have a discussion. So I'd like to really try and make sure we have time for our three panelists to talk with each other, and then we have a 15-minute session at the end for questions from the from you. So without further ado, actually, I just want to say something that where I come from, Australia, there's a protocol that whenever we have a meeting like this, there's a protocol of acknowledging whose land you're on, and we're currently standing on Mohawk land. So I'd actually like to ask Mr. Kenneth Deer to begin to welcome us to his country.
Thank you. it's a pleasure and honor to be here and to be able to speak with all of you along with my other panelists. On behalf of the chiefs and clan mothers, the men, the women, and children of the Mohawk people, I bring you greetings, and to your chiefs and your women leadership and your men and women and children, and we wish you all well and welcome to our territory. In our tradition, we tend to, when we have guests, there's a ceremony for you at what's called the edge of the woods, where we dust you off after your long journey from wherever you come from. You know, we tend to, I'll give you a short version here. You know, we like to clean your ears with the eagle feather so that you can hear us clearly. You know, and take all the dust out of your ears from your travel. We like to take a soft deer cloth and wipe your eyes so that you can see clearly now that you're here. And also we give you some fresh spring water to clear your throat, to take that lump out of your throat from all your travels, and so you can speak clearly. You know. So now that you're being refreshed, I hope that you can see us, you can hear us, and together we can speak with each other, and that in our dialogue that we have, that we can come to an understanding with one another, and that when we leave here, we can all leave with one mind all together. So that's our short version of our greetings. And Mohawk territory, by the way, is here from the island of Montreal, roughly, to all the way south past Albany, New York. So Mohawk territory is on both sides of the Canadian-U.S. border. And as a Mohawk, I consider myself a Mohawk, not a Canadian or American citizen, but a Mohawk of the Six Nations Iroquois Confederacy. But saying that, I'll get quickly into what I have to say. And I'll give you a North American perspective on the development of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. And it all started over many years. But we became very frustrated with the legal system in both Canada and the United States, and we felt that we could not get justice in the domestic situation. So we decided, particularly among traditional Indigenous peoples in the Americas, to bring our grievances into the international forum, because we just can't get justice at home. So we started a campaign to bring our issues to the United Nations. And in the United Nations, we were lumped in as a minorities, like other minorities. And so we had to convince, first of all, that the Indigenous peoples were different, that we have a different we're a different situation than quote unquote minorities. So we had to, and there's a difference, and I had to explain this to you because not everybody really understands this, is that there's a difference between minority rights and Indigenous rights. And while those many similarities, minorities have a right to language, Indigenous have a right to language, have a right to our culture, we have a right to our spirituality, we can run our own education systems if we want to. But there's a fundamental difference between minorities and Indigenous, and that is that Indigenous people have a right to self-determination. Indigenous people have a right to land, territory, and natural resources on that territories. And that's a fundamental difference between minorities and Indigenous people. Because I'll use the Italian minority in Canada. The Italian minority can come to Canada. They can have they can speak their language. They can have their own schools. They can practice their culture, their religion, etc. But Italians exercise the right to self-determination in Italy, and lands and territories in Italy, not here in Canada. We, on the other hand, like the Mohawks and others here, this is the only place in the world where we can exercise self-determination, because this is our homeland. This is our territory. And this is the only place where we can exercise that. We can't go to Italy and exercise our right to self-determination over there. So that's the fundamental difference. And so when we approached the United Nations, they created the working group on Indigenous populations. And one of the first things we wanted them to do was to draft a declaration on the rights of Indigenous peoples. And from 1982, when the working group was created, there were five members of that working group, none of whom were Indigenous, of course. This is a UN we're talking about. And we had to educate these five people on who we are and what we believe our rights are. It started a long process of developing the declaration. And from I only began getting involved in 1987. And at that time, there were 12 articles in the declaration. And at that time, there were people telling us, and we were still fighting to add more. When the declaration was finally finished in 1990, the first drafting was finished in 1993, they ended up with 45 articles by the time we were done. One of the last articles to be inserted into the declaration was the right to self-determination, Article 3, because going back to 87, 88, 89, 90, 91, academics and human rights experts saying that you will never get self-determination. There are scholars saying Indigenous peoples do not have a right to self-determination. This is the kind of opposition that we had even at the international and at the academic level. But after, over time, things change. More and more academics start saying, Indigenous peoples are peoples like all other peoples. The whole objective of the United Nations was not to recognize us as peoples. It's such an important word for us. But in 1993, the last thing the working group did was to add Article 3. Indigenous peoples have a right to self-determination. And in the preamble, it says Indigenous peoples are equal to all other peoples. So there are two very important statements, and that's the fundamental part. It's the fundamental basis for the rights of Indigenous people, the human rights of Indigenous people. Not only the human rights, though, I have to say that Indigenous peoples have the rights of peoples. it's a collective right. You know, right to self-determination is a collective right. And how we exercise those rights, we do that collectively, and that's where we also have a clash between human rights as an individual right and how we feel our rights, our human rights, are also can be exercised collectively. And there's a clash that we still have today to this minute. Now, recently in the UN, we're still fighting over the definition of indigenous rights, whether indigenous rights are actually human rights, still being resisted by countries like the United States and Canada. Anyway, so this whole issue of self-determination is just a fundamental underpinning of our rights. And this is how we self-determination is we would have our own we can define our own political status and freely pursue our economic, social, and cultural development. And this is exactly what indigenous people have been trying to do ever since in American context since Columbus. Fell on our land, and the restriction, the denial of our right to our own political status and economic, social, and cultural development has been a conflict ever since at that time. The Declaration tries to correct that, and the Declaration has numerous rights are all on there. I have to tell you a small little story though during the negotiations in Geneva, we were at a reception when we were debating on self-determination. And at this reception, I was at the food table, of course, and the Brazilian diplomat was standing next to me, and he says, Mr. Deere, he says, I can understand why you're so passionate about self-determination. He says, because you have the moral argument on your side. And I said, does that mean you have the immoral argument? And he paused for a minute, and he said, yes. So the governments know that they're on soft ground on this, and we know that we have the high moral ground on these arguments, and that's all we need is to have the high moral ground, and that's why we'll never lose, I mean, at least in our hearts and our minds, we will never lose, So the Declaration in this debate has all those rights that I talked about earlier: self-determination, land, education, health, shelter. You're all experts in here. You all know what that list is. One of the arguments statements have been made that even though because it's a declaration, the rights are not binding. That the declaration is not binding, and it's true that and declarations are not like conventions. Conventions are binding. However, the rights that are defined inside the declaration though are binding in other instruments. So when people say that the declaration is not binding, what value is it? But what the declaration is a way for a guideline for states to how to apply existing international norms and standards, human rights standards, to indigenous people. It instructs governments how indigenous people have a right to health, they have a right to education, they have a right to their own spirituality, they have a right to self-determination. It's like a map for states, and those rights are binding. So if a state says, well, the declaration is not binding, well, fine, but the covenants are, the covenants are binding, and because you signed them. And for most of you, anyway, so using the declaration, when they say it's not binding, that might be true technically, but the rights inside are, and that's the argument that's what's so important about the declaration, because it guides us, all of us, indigenous, non-indigenous states, to how to apply the rights that are binding in other instruments, and that's a very, very important part of this declaration. Of course, I can't. Talk about the Declaration without mentioning Canada. When the Declaration, after a lot of negotiations, over years, it was passed by the Working Group on Indigenous Populations in 1993. And I note the word populations. The United Nations didn't want to call this the Working Group on Indigenous Peoples because peoples implies rights, so they wouldn't want populations don't have rights, so that's why it's called populations. The Subcommittee on the Protection and Promotion of Human Rights passed it without changes in 1994. It was called a different name at that time, though, that body. Then in 1995, the states got hold of it on the Human Rights Commission. They created their own working group to elaborate the declaration. Then we started another 11-year battle at that level to maintain the draft declaration. And that went on from 1995 to 2006. And it's a long story I don't want to get into. It was a beautiful, a wonderful battle. I was so impressed with the indigenous leadership that would come to these meetings to defend the rights of indigenous people. And if those of you who were there, you would have seen some of the best debates you have ever heard, I've ever heard anyway, about defending the rights of indigenous peoples, and the stupidest remarks by states that you'll ever hear too about why indigenous people shouldn't have certain rights. But anyway, it went to the Human Rights Council. The first meeting, the very, very first meeting at the Human Rights Commission was dissolved because of for political reasons, and it created a whole new body, the Human Rights Council, and then the declaration was the second document to be voted on, it was passed. There were only two countries voted against it. Russia and Canada voted against it at the Human Rights Council. Then it went to the New York, to the General Assembly. We're in the third committee. We got ambushed in the third committee by African states. Even though the African states voted in favor of it in Geneva at the Human Rights Council, somehow African states got nervous, and I think, I can't prove it, but I think Canada had something to do with that, scaring the states, so that when they got to the third committee in New York, Africa ambushed us and demanded that the declaration be reviewed. And not only was this a blow against us, it was a blow against the Human Rights Council, because usually anything that's passed by the Human Rights Council gets rubber stamped by the General Assembly. So this undermined the authority of the Human Rights Council. Anyway, the African wanted, I can't remember how many, 46, 47 changes or more than that. In the end, after hard negotiations with the help of Mexico and Guatemala, we narrowed it down to 9 changes, one which was positive, 2 were neutral, and the other 6 were watered it down a bit. One of the things they added into there was territorial integrity in Article 46, which we fought for how many years, and we thought we won it, but Africans managed to put territorial integrity back into the declaration, which was, we thought, was a bit of a defeat. However, nevertheless, the document as it stands, has 46 articles, was voted upon, went to the General Assembly in September 13th, 2007, and at that time, 4 countries. I was in the gallery, and I was trying to betting on how many governments would vote against it, and we knew there was some resistance. So I was expecting maybe 11 or 12 states would vote against the declaration. In the end, when all the green lights went up, only 4 states voted against: Canada, United States, Australia, and New Zealand. And Canada is the only country that voted against the declaration twice. The only country in the world to do that, once at the Human Rights Council and once in the General Assembly. And since that time, New Zealand and Australia have endorsed the declaration, thank God. The United States has said that they are, under Obama administration, they're reconsidering their position and reviewing their position. Canada, on the other hand, has said that in its throne speech last March 3rd that they are going to endorse the declaration. But they haven't endorsed the declaration. It's been 6 months since they said that, and they haven't done it. And there's been no change in the Canadian position since that time. Last November, at the Convention on Biodiversity negotiations here in Montreal, we met with the Canadian government delegation. When I brought up the declaration and the rights in the declaration, the delegation told us that don't talk to us about the declaration. We have our instructions are not to not to oppose any reference to the declaration. So don't talk to us about it. It's not our decision. So I asked, where did you get your instructions from? And he said, from the highest levels of the Canadian government, which is the Prime Minister's office. You know. So there's no debate. There's no discussion. So but after this promise in the throne speech, we had a meeting about 3 weeks ago, a month ago, here in Montreal, and I asked that very same question to the very same delegation, and they said, now that you've promised to endorse it, have you changed your position? And they said, no. They said, we have no change of instructions, and even though it was mentioned in the throne speech, they will endorse, but they haven't endorsed it, so they're still taking that same position of obstructing the declaration. They don't agree that the word obstruction was, but I'm sure that's the word they used, was obstruct, last, obstruct was last November. So in my opinion, it's insincere. Canada's position is to endorse the declaration is an insincere offer. It's like if somebody's punching you in the face and then you say, well, stop it. It says, okay, we'll stop it, but not right now. And 6 months later, they're still punching you in the face. Well, it's not a sincere offer to endorse the declaration. And Canada still has to change its position. We suspect they only made that statement. One is to deflect criticism. They didn't want to be the last government to endorse a declaration because they were afraid the U.S. was going to do it. And thirdly, they want to get a seat on the Security Council. So they didn't want to be looking like there's somebody as a country objecting to human rights. So those are the only suspicions that we have that Canada would make such a statement and yet not change their position. I'll stop there. I have lots more to say, but I'm running out of time, even though I'm on my own territory.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you.
Next up, we have Isabel.
Thank you. Good morning, everybody. I would like to acknowledge and thank Mr. Deer for welcoming into Mohawk territory. In my presentation, what I would like to use is use colonialism as a framework to interrogate human rights and its emancipatory possibilities. And I think that human rights, and these are some of the issues that have been addressed since yesterday and particularly this morning, human rights as a field, as an emancipatory field that emerged after the Second World War, was concerned with violence and genocide in the European context. And it allowed for the genocides against European people to be seen through different lenses, because the genocides committed against other peoples were not necessarily considered at the same level. So from this perspective, I would like to argue that human rights have been constituted on the rejection of the other, meaning indigenous people, savages, and so on. And the incorporation of the other into human rights have been based on essentialized notions of culture. And in my view, these two things work to codify people and places into who resembles the West best and who is willing to talk about human rights and to talk about democracy and so on. And the other issue is that this particular framework allows for the state itself to use and manipulate human rights in different ways. So on the one hand, human rights have been used to transform the colonial state into a compassionate state concerned with the incorporation of the demands of different people, but at the same time, it sort of opens some vacuums where the state can use and manipulate these discourses to reject either, for instance, the Declaration of the Human Rights, or simply to ignore some forms of structural violence that exist and are committed against indigenous women. Because in human rights, violence are seen as a source of rights, sometimes the way violence is constructed tends to downplay the violence that the state have perpetrated and have created through different legislations, through different policies, and, you know, for the Canadian context, we can talk about the Indian Act, and we can talk about different other legislations. And where I come from, also, although in Mexico we are not talking about a colonial settler society, the government has adopted the same arguments that in some settler societies have used to oppose certain rights of indigenous peoples, and also to use the issue, or I shouldn't say issue, but the concerns of indigenous women to basically infringe upon the collective rights of indigenous peoples. I would like to talk a little bit about these forms of violence and how they have been articulated from the local level. One of the issues that we have heard often is that indigenous women are discriminated against within their own communities, that they don't have to access to the same resources. Again, in the Canadian context, we're talking, for instance, the issue of matrimonial property right. In Mexico, for instance, an important aspect of this would be, you know, that normative systems have been recognized as part of the pluralist legal system. But at the same time, the state uses these forms of discrimination against women to basically disqualify indigenous cultures, indigenous normative systems, and so on, and basically argue using the image of the indigenous female victim to basically say, you know, this, the state has a responsibility to go and intervene into these communities and save the poor, powerless indigenous women. When in reality, what happens in this articulation is that we are ignoring that indigenous women are agents and they know exactly what kind of violence are operating. But more importantly, we need to think that some of these violence are blamed on indigenous cultures, but if we just scratch a little bit the surface, we will see that these forms of discrimination and these forms of violence have actually been created through state legislations, through state policies, but we use the image of the female victim to basically say, if indigenous women want to enjoy rights, the only possibility they have is through the enjoyment of individual rights and by distancing themselves from their natures and from their culture. But I also concerned with how this notion of, human rights as an emancipatory field somehow ignore the multi-layer experiences of gender, ethnicity, colonization, and so on, and create sort of a vacuum where non-state forms of violence go unrecorded. And I'm thinking, for instance, the issue of the missing women in Canada, but also in Mexico, that are related to racialized and sexualized forms of violence. Although at the local level, family members and organizations and NGO were making a lot of noise in terms of saying, look, this is happening in our countries, and these are issues that we need to address that are related to structural racism, to poverty, and so on. It wasn't until relatively recently that Amnesty International or academics started to pay attention to these situations. And in my view, while we are starting to pay attention to it, there is a lot of misunderstanding among a lot of people and the wider society why these issues happened. The report of the Manitoba Inquiry, for instance, in 1999, and also Amnesty International, 2004, basically argued that it's racism. There is a lot of racism that perpetuates these assumptions about indigenous women being overrepresented in the sex trade. And even worse, there is an assumption that if indigenous women are part of this sex trade, they are somehow located in a space of violent eruptions, of where violence is sort of like inherent into these spaces. And in my view, that's just a way of taking responsibility away from the state instead of saying, you know, there is a legacy of colonialism that we need to talk about, that we need to address in order to understand why these issues are happening. And in Mexico, for instance, the missing women in Juarez, at the border with the United States, for many, many years, the state, the government will basically say, well, there is one single killer, a crazy killer that is committed these crimes, even though there has been a lot of evidence saying, you know, this is not necessarily the pattern of a single killer. There is something else going on here. There is sort of like a lawless space where nobody wants to intervene, nobody wants to take responsibility. And in that process, we are failing as a society, and the states are, as well, are failing these women instead of addressing these issues. So in trying to engage with a conversation with all of you, I think that if we really want to move beyond a modernist understanding of human rights, we need to interrogate the colonial framework in which such rights are articulated. But we also need to include the other into the conversation, as opposed to just rights that are defined for the purpose of making some societies to resemble the West. At the same time, more than describing the positive content of humanity, community, and morality, human rights needs to specify how these different dimensions can be constructed dialogically by starting from difference instead of rejecting difference. Confronting colonialism in history, knowledge, and culture doesn't mean rejecting the principle of humanist project. Rather, it means that we construct knowledge based on the relationship or the recognition of relationships and interrelations. I believe that if we continue to speak of human rights in hierarchical terms, the emancipatory possibilities are always going to be limited, because we're giving the states too much power to decide what rights or what kind of languages to adopt and what kind of instruments to bring into the table. And to be clear, my critique of human rights is a constructive one, and it aims at putting some human dignity into this conversation. Thank you.
Thank you, Isabel. Eddie?
Thank you. First, Ken, thank you very much for having me at your place. Somehow that just doesn't quite work, putting it that way. What I really need to say, Ken, is tēnā koe te rangatira. O tō āwhina mai ki a mātou. Koe tai mai tēnei rā. Ki te whakawhiti e nei kōrero i roto i a mātou. What I'm getting at is this. Sometimes it takes languages to express what you really mean to say, and what is so important when we are looking at Indigenous people's rights is that the English language and the law especially does not really capture the spirit of what we are looking for and what we are intending to say. We have a different worldview, and we have a series of respect protocols that we use in which we can define our relationships with other people. And it's so important for us, I think, to be able to begin in that way. But I also want to begin by thanking the organizers of this conference for inviting me here. I thought that last night's session was absolutely stunning. It provided such a range of thoughts and a range of ideas. And for those like myself who are practicing in the field, not as an academic, but out there trying to achieve particular results, now for my own tribal group, it is really valuable to be able to come along and hear so many diverse people from different countries expressing their own experiences. I would particularly like to thank Professor Kotler's mother for the description that she gave of the pursuit of justice, that the key to it, she said, was to feel the injustice And that, I think, provides a very important strategy for dealing with the rights, the human rights of different groups. You don't get to the point, you don't begin to understand the case unless you really feel and understand the circumstances that you're dealing with. See, as I see it, what we have here is a range of different experiences. And it's a case of having different horses for different courses. You can't say that there's just one type of thing that applies to all people. You've got to find what's right for the particular occasion. It's as though we have a great smorgasbord of rights. Then what we've got to do is to find the right or the principle that is most appropriate for the particular case. And that, I think, is what judging is all about. The key to judging is finding the facts, getting the facts right, getting to understand what the problem is, getting to understand why people are hurting, why they feel hurt. Then the principle, the proper principle to apply, just falls naturally into place. You don't have to go on a big hunt. You don't have to go on a big search. You don't have to try and work out how in this broad scheme of things you balance individual rights against group rights. You have to feel for what is the problem in the particular case. Then the answers, I think, will start to present themselves. And that, I thought, has been a valuable part of this conference for me, is to be able to see the wide diversity of circumstances and to be able to think what would be the appropriate principle to apply in order to manage that particular case, rather than to see some great jurisprudential structure that we need to apply. Now, I want to talk a little bit about the New Zealand situation. We have three major official policies in our country that describe the relationship between Māori people, that's the indigenous people, and the government. The first is the promotion of the indigenous language, which I value most of all, because the language is the window to the soul of our people. That is something that I think has proceeded in New Zealand with rather good success. I don't want to go into the detail of it. The second is the provision of social services to indigenous peoples, the Māori people, through their own tribal and urban authorities. And that too, I think, is working rather well, substantially because we have in New Zealand our own Māori political party, which, because of the proportional representation system that we have in the government, in our electoral system, means that this party is now in coalition with the government, and so it is able to get some of its policies across. They are able to ensure that social services are delivered to Māori people in an appropriate way, or at least they're trying to move in that direction. The third major development, and the one that has been mentioned in the theme for this session, is the negotiation for settlements of the historic claims of the Māori people. And this is where, I regret to say, we stuff up rather badly. That's a difficult thing to say, because the opposite opinion is the one that is usually broadcast abroad. The reason for so saying is that what is called a negotiations process is really, as I see it... Is this still going? It is. Is really, as I see it, a system of government grants. It's not really a negotiation. And this for four reasons. The first is that the process has been settled by governments alone. It is not prescribed by statute. It is not prescribed in some formal way, so that we cannot take any departures from the standard to the courts on judicial review. There are no remedies. The second is that the government determines how much is going to be paid by way of compensation. There's not really room for negotiation. Treasury has already prepared the budget. The third is that the mandate of the tribal negotiators is determined by government process, not by tribal processes whereby we determine tribal representatives ourselves. And the fourth is that the entities that are established to receive the settlement funds must meet government standards, which are not the same as tribal standards. And this is having a rather serious effect, as I see it, on the way that tribal communities are organized and arranged. Now, that's not the main problem. The main problem, as I see it, is that the people who are responsible for the system are the most well-meaning and well-intentioned people that you could come across. The system was developed by ministers of the Crown who are highly regarded in New Zealand by Maori and non-Maori alike because of their deep concern for Indigenous people. And the process has become heavily bureaucratized. The problem is this, for Indigenous people, that the bureaucrats who are running this thing are deeply committed to serving the interests of Indigenous people. So what's gone wrong? How can we possibly address the situation? It's very difficult for Maori people to complain, and you don't wish to complain. Especially, I don't want to be seen complaining in New Zealand, because I'm now there representing my own tribal group, working with my own tribal group. We're going to try and get a generous settlement. We're not going to get it by criticizing the very people who are going to give us the check. They talk at great length, for example, in New Zealand about the need for an apology, and government is really good at making these apologies. They write some really beautiful ones. But for us, the process has become one of so jumping through bureaucratic hoops in order to be able to get to the check at the end of the process that our people are saying, don't worry too much about the apology, just write it on the back of the check. We're going through these extraordinary processes, and yet there's just a complete mismatch between what government is wanting to do and the way we see things as happening for ourselves. So why is it? Why is it that we can't get this sort of match? Why is it that government people feel that in order to do the best thing by us, they must do it? They must do it in their way and according to their controls. Is there something about Indigenous people that make us inherently untrustworthy, that we cannot establish the entities as we would like to see them established? Let me just illustrate the sort of things that can happen. Government says to us that in order to be able to get through the settlement, there must be a vote by the members that belong to the tribal group, and they then determine the membership. They say, well, the membership consists of all those people who descend from an ancestor, because every good anthropologist knows that tribal groups in New Zealand are defined by descent from an ancestor. The problem is this, that includes a whole lot of people who are living in London, Australia, and all over the world, who have now no understanding of what is happening with their own communities. We are not actually defined by descent. We are characterized by descent. But it has always been our situation that people have moved from one tribe to another tribe with great flexibility. You marry into this group or into that group. What constitutes the tribe at the end of the day is the people who are there in the cookhouse, the people who are there performing the necessary ceremonial functions. It's the people on the ground. That's what constitutes the community. And yet somehow governments will define our communities for us according to some broad system of having to get in votes from all people after registration, and they're scattered all around the world. You know what the problem there is? The problem is a fundamental misunderstanding between the place of the individual and the identity of the group. How does the group itself define itself? We do not define ourselves in terms of absentees. We define ourselves in terms of those who are there on the ground. Now, there's a whole series of these sorts of problems that exist. Why is it then that in a country that prides itself so much on human rights and which so genuinely wishes to do the right thing, we cannot actually get it right? Is there anything in the United Nations or in the human rights discourse that helps to answer these sorts of problems? Well, for a long time there, human rights didn't get us very far down the track, at least for Indigenous people. I'm not wishing to put down human rights, but they did not seem to meet our particular circumstances. The United Nations, for example, or the human rights people, kept talking in terms of rights. We just don't talk in those terms. We talk in terms of our responsibilities to our children, the responsibilities of children to the adults, the respect that children must pay towards their elders, the responsibility that men have to women and women to men, our responsibilities for the care of the environment. We have a system of duties rather than of rights, so that the language didn't quite fit with us. But can the human rights system help? Absolutely, and Ken has already explained it. The most wonderful thing to have happened in New Zealand since the time that we were annexed as a British colony in 1840 has been New Zealand's recognition and subscription to the Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples that Ken has already talked about. Because if you look at each of these four problems that I have described about states prescribing the negotiations process, about states settling how tribes are to be constructed, about how things are to happen, you'll find that there's an answer for each and every one of them within the Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous People. And you know, I've been on the bench for a very long time. I was on the bench for about 30 years. And in the whole of that time, I never had counsel while I was giving a judgment send me up a note to say, you have 1 minute to go. But it's actually a very good way. It would help judges a lot, I think, if we had that sort of system practices operating on the bench. But there's the problem, and I needn't take it any further. I think the sooner we get on to the discussion, the better. So we'll leave it there.
Well, thank you all three of you so much. You've given us a lot to work with there. I think I'm just going to open it up to all of you to see how you might want to respond to each other. I have a few questions if we fall into silence.
I'd like to hear what the audience has, any questions they have.
Okay, you want to go straight to audience questions? All right. So I'd just like to ask you, when you're trying to, just make sure you ask a question. Sometimes people tend to fill in the audience with a lot of background about what they research in and what their interests are, but we are limited in time, so if you could just make sure that you have a specific question to ask the panel. Thank you.
I don't know if you need this for recording. I'm Arlene Jennings. I'm a member of Parliament in the House of Commons of Parliament of Canada, member of the Liberal Party of Canada, and the Justice Critic. of citizenship amongst that Aboriginal nation and the issue of matrimonial property. I have serious concerns about this legislation, both pieces, and I would like to hear from the panelists about how they believe that government should work with our Indigenous people here in Canada, our First Nations, to deal with this, because we have a judgment of the Supreme Court of Canada on the issue of citizenship. And so the government of the day says it's trying to respect that judgment. But we've been told, I've been told as a parliamentarian, that by advocates and representatives of various First Nations, that there was virtually no consultation that took place, and that the issue of citizenship can vary from nation to nation, and therefore it really did need for government to sit down with all of the nations to try and have them come up with a term. So I'd like to hear from you, because you can really inform my own, myself and my colleagues on what position Liberals should be taking on these two pieces of legislation. We have problems with both of them. And hi, Mr. Gere, you don't remember me, but we've met way back when. I really like you.
you should come back more often. Can I answer?
Please go.
Well, to answer, I'm not an expert on the two pieces of legislation. I tend not to read them because it gets depressing. But I will tell you what I believe is, and that when it comes to the problem with the Canadian government is that it tries to make a cookie cutter legislation that fits for all people, and it doesn't work. Indigenous people from coast to coast are different. We are different peoples. You know, we're not all the same. You know, yes, we're Indigenous, and or you call us Native or Aboriginal, but we're not the same, and we're different. We have different languages, different cultures, different land base. Some are live off the land. Some are hunter gatherers, some are fishermen. You can't just take one piece of legislation and try and apply it to all, unless what the government should be doing is allowing ourselves to decide for ourselves who we are. The Canadian government shouldn't decide who is Indigenous. The Creator already decided who is Indigenous. All right, he put us here. So that decision has already been made. And those of us who are here, we will decide for ourselves who should be Mohawk, who should be Mi'kmaq, who should be Cree. It's our decision. And the Canadian government should just take their nose out of that. You know, we'll take care of that. And the same thing with matrimonial property rights. The whole issue is a Canadian-created problem. You know, it's Canadian legislation that created the property issues in Canada, and they're not any good. They create the problem, and they're not any better at fixing it. You know, and they have not been listening to Indigenous peoples in Canada to resolve it. The Native women who are, and there's one representative here who might want to speak to it. They have their own recommendations, which to help resolve that issue, and they're not being listened to. The Canadian government is extremely paternalistic in the last 4 years. And that paternalism, we have right-wing governments, and that paternalism is showing through, and Indigenous people in Canada have less and less and less voice and less influence on very important issues that affect us. And it's a serious problem, and I hope that the next government will be much, much better. Thank you.
Can I just jump on that?
Yeah.
I would like to add to these questions a couple of things. First of all, that when we talk about matrimonial property rights in to solve some of the crises that exist within Indigenous communities, the way it has been framed in the legislation is basically to introduce some form of private property on Indigenous lands, and that's extremely problematic. The government, when it started with this initiative, basically said, well, we're going to hold this consultation, and the report, for instance, from the Native Women Association of Canada is that they acknowledge that there is a housing crisis, and that overwhelmingly affects women. But at the same time, they argue that women cannot be used as an excuse to, again, bring about property rights into a land that is held collectively and to introduce individualization and so on. And in their report, they argue as well that, you know, First Nations peoples are extremely diverse and that they let them define their own codes. And and that never was part of the process. They complained that this consultation wasn't really meaningful in this sense. So, yes, it is an issue. So why not include the people who are the most affected in how to define these codes, in how to define these pieces of legislation? So,
can I just pick up on the point that was made here? I don't want to comment on local domestic legislation when I don't really understand what the particular issues and the particular points are. But I do want to follow on from what Isabel had to say, that it is so very, very important for Indigenous people to define their own codes in dealing with matters. One of the great problems that we've always had in New Zealand from the beginning of time was the expectation, was the practice, rather, of European judges, or judges of European origin, imposing their own views on how they see Indigenous societies being structured. For example, let me just give you, refer to one case from the family law area. It concerns a situation in customary society where sometimes a widower who has a young family, his wife has passed on, but there's a young family there, a younger sister who is not yet married, there is an expectation that she will marry him in order to ensure that the children are kept within her side of the family, the mother's side of the family, and don't get taken over by the father's side. So the judge hearing this in the Māori Land Court says to the people, well, is this a custom? Is this part of your practice or is it not? Is it a rule or is it not a rule? And the people there are saying to the judge, well, it is a rule and it isn't a rule. And he said, well, come on, I need to know, is it a rule or is it not a rule? And they would say, well, it depends. And they say, well, it depends on what? Well, for example, she might not want to marry him. And what the problem we constantly have is the European expectation that there is an absolute rule by which customary society can be defined, when the real problem is that there is not. There's a smorgasbord of rights and principles that you can apply, and it's a question of finding the right principle to apply to the case. That's why I so much like Indigenous law. And that's why we must define our own codes, because they will get it wrong.
Go ahead. Yes, good morning. My name is Marie Wilson. I'm one of the commissioners with the Indian Residential School Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and I would just like to begin by thanking Ken for the beautiful welcome and explanation of your cultural traditional welcome, and thank all of you for your presentations. I have two specific questions. I'll just ask them together, and I can repeat the one if I need to. I would be very interested in knowing, in the case of New Zealand, Justice Drury, what... because New Zealand is one of the two countries that changed its mind about the UN Declaration, and I would be interested in knowing what happened, what was going on to make that shift possible, what were the factors that led to the change. The other question that I have is a broader one, and it's just to know your own thoughts, all of you, or whoever wants to speak to it, or the room for that matter. What is the correlation, do you think, between representation of Indigenous peoples in publicly elected democratic structures and the practices of human rights within that country? And I say that knowing that in most of the examples I'm aware of, there's a significant underrepresentation. But I also know that in some quarters there's an attitude that people don't want to be in that government. They would rather express through a parallel government system. And I just wonder your thoughts on whether that is one of the key problems or whether that's not something that should be addressed at all. So, thank you.
Well, I'd like to jump in quickly in order to capture the easy one and leave the second question for the others. But I would like to think that New Zealand subscribed to the declaration because it was moved by some higher order of principle. But that is not, in fact, the case as I see it. It was dragged there screaming. It came about, in my view, although I don't think the government would like to admit to it, came about because, again, under our system of representation, the MMP, proportional representation system, a Maori party came into power. It came into power because the government needed it to constitute a government. And it put the pressure on. This was one of its conditions, that government would subscribe. So let's look at the open-hearted, large-spirited way in which it subscribed. It said, first of all, it doesn't matter so much, it's only aspirational. It's not a real binding thing. It's only an aspirational thing. Now, the trouble with that view is that I think that that statements of higher order principle are more effective in time than strictly binding laws in influencing the direction that a country takes. Statements of higher principle creep into the law in time simply because politicians become convinced after a while of the merit of it, and secondly because judges are always searching for principle to apply. And they will use the declaration in many cases, I am sure. But the government didn't go there for that reason, and it said it is only aspirational. The second thing is that it couched its acceptance with a number of conditions. And one of the most extraordinary ones is that nothing in there would conflict with anything in our own domestic statute law. It's not really an acceptance of the declaration at all. But to me, that doesn't matter. I don't care whether New Zealand subscribed to it or not. It is something that we can use convincingly in New Zealand whether or not it has been subscribed to, simply because the nations of the world, 153 of them, think that it's a very important statement of principle. We can use it with or without New Zealand subscription.
Would either of you like to respond to either of the questions?
Well, I thought the second question was also to New Zealand about about participation in a state government. I think the Maori Party has shown that it can influence a government when it forms part of the government. When it's in opposition, though, I don't know how much influence it has. You know, I think that there are times when Indigenous people have been there have been some good fortunate. I guess perhaps by luck, for instance, Elijah Harper stopping the was it the Kelowna? No, Charlottetown?
Charlottetown Accord.
The Kelowna Accord? Which one did he? Not the Kelowna.
No.
Meech Lake, that's it. You know, we had one single Indigenous person in the Manitoba legislation, one individual person stopped the Meech Lake Accord, which is an amendment to the Canadian Constitution, I believe, and he was able, this one Indigenous person was able to stop it. And to me, that was an absolute wonderful thing, but also a tremendous fluke in the sense that it just turned out that way. It turned out so well. Otherwise, so in our beliefs, we believe that we are a people and we are a nation, and that we believe in a nation-to-nation relationship with the government of Canada, and as equals. You know, when we talk about equality, we don't mean that. One Mohawk is equal to one Canadian. We look at it as a Mohawk nation being equal to Canada. That's the equality that we seek and that we want to continue. And it's a treaty relationship, really. It's the same, very, very same thing, where you have one people making an agreement, a binding agreement, an internationally binding agreement with another is based on treaty. And that's the relationship that we demand. And that's our relationship with both the French when they came and the British when they came and the Americans when they separated from Britain and with Canada when now that Canada separated from Britain. And if Quebec ever separates from Canada, that's the kind of relationship we'll have with Quebec, you know, because Europeans keep dividing and you know, that's the way they are. You know. And the Yugoslavia is another example. But we believe that our relationship, the equality relationship that we have, is that one people to another, and that the, and that's what we want to maintain. And I think that's how, if we're ever going to be, if Canada ever and the United States ever evolve to a higher, I guess, level of civilization, that we can have that kind of a relationship between ourselves and them. And that's our goal. And that's not going to change. That's our position. It's a position that the Mohawk and the Haudenosaunee, other people, are not going to change that position. We teach our children that, and we'll teach our grandchildren that we are a people, and that equal to other peoples, that we should be treated that way. And we're not interested in getting involved in Canadian politics or Canadian parties and stuff like that. We don't think that's our place. That's for Canadians. That's not for us. And we'll live or die by that by that position.
Just really quickly, I think that sometimes there are some opportunities for making some changes through when indigenous peoples are represented in the political system. But I also think that there are the way a lot of electoral systems are organized based on partisans' principles and priorities, and that the possibilities for addressing or advancing human rights and or the rights of indigenous peoples are sometimes cut off between, you know, the partisan priorities and what that local community wants to do. And just to speak from Mexico, from the Mexicans' perspective, it was thanks to indigenous peoples being represented in the electoral system, but also indigenous organizations, that the ILO covenant and the Declaration of the Human Rights of Indigenous Peoples have been ratified. But what happens after that is that the government decided to craft its own national legislation, sort of like a, you know, something in between to meet this universal declaration and its local application. But in the process of doing that, it actually changed the spirit of the universal declaration. So at the end of the day, what we have in this law that they call indigenous law is that, yes, normative systems are recognized. But the problem is that the way we understand normative systems as indigenous peoples is that everything is integrated there. But they separated that the idea of conflict resolution and regulation within the community from an extremely, extremely important aspect, that of natural resources. So at the end of the day, you're sort of like it's fragmenting or compartmentalizing all these different rights and all these different aspects. If you recognize some but not others, you are not really doing that much. To really be self-determining people, we also need that economic control over our own territories and control over our own natural resources.
Hello. I was curious, when you have a government that doesn't respect indigenous rights or treaty rights, how you see the role of NGOs?
How do we see the world as NGOs?
How do you see the role?
What role do the non-governmental
organizations
play?
Oh, the role of NGOs.
Play.
Well, first of all, the NGO, our experience is that many NGOs, I can't say all NGOs, I can say many NGOs have been very helpful and supportive, because I think the NGOs tend to be more principled and less political than states, although there are exceptions to that. I think there are some gongos have political agendas and have sometimes work against indigenous peoples. But in many cases, in our experiences at the international level, is that NGOs have been very supportive of indigenous people, have come and have made very, very strong statements supporting the rights of indigenous peoples. And that does influence states at times. You know, if you get an NGO like Amnesty can come up with a strong statement, Amnesty can influence some countries, Western countries that have high human rights standards. And if Amnesty says something, they tend to listen. Even small NGOs that are specific for indigenous people have been very supportive, not only in supporting us, our positions, but also in supporting indigenous people financially and physically to get to, for instance, Geneva. Very expensive for indigenous people to go to Geneva, and there are a number of NGOs in Europe supply funding for indigenous representatives to get to Geneva to be able to fight for indigenous rights at that level. And without the support of NGOs in Europe, we wouldn't have been able to do that. We wouldn't have been able to have a large number of indigenous representatives at the UN to fight for our rights and to convince states that this declaration is a good idea. So I, my experience is that most NGOs are very, very, very helpful.
Please go ahead.
Utkun oradus gatita gosne yajat stano waganyato kanya kaha gagyanto datano kanasata agna ganagare utkun oradus agwaguta dawanara ne ki ka kanya kaha kong kwahunsa igwat kanisa are thano no tese wa thare ki sawani sarate. My name is Ellen Gabriel. I am a Turtle Clan from the community, Mohawk community of Gunasadaga. I am president of Quebec Native Women's Association. And I want to thank you for your talks this morning. They've been very informative. And I really appreciate the knowledge that you have shared with us. I have been participating in the discussions and Convention on Biodiversity on the access to benefit sharing, where traditional knowledge of indigenous peoples is at stake and is threatened by states like Canada, New Zealand, Australia, and others who want to minimize our position in protection of traditional knowledge and our resources, and genetic resources and our resources, period. My frustration goes towards a question. Every state that is part of the UN has obligations under the UN Charter. And it seems that it's okay to punish countries like Iraq or other countries that have obvious human rights violations, obvious violations of the UN Charter. But when it comes to the big donating countries like Canada and the US, the UN remains silent. And I find it's a hypocrisy within the UN, where within the biodiversity discussions, they refuse to accept the term peoples. They call us indigenous and local communities. And as Kenneth has pointed out, we are not minorities. We are nations, self-determining nations. And many courts, whether they're here in Canada, the U.S., Australia, or New Zealand, have a very hegemonic point of view in the decisions and how they provide decisions. You know, we always have to go to court to prove our inherent rights. And I don't think we have anything to prove. I think it's Canada and the U.S. and all these colonized imperialistic countries that have something to prove. So one of the things I just don't understand, and I do understand, it's more of a thing, is that indigenous people have been saying the same thing for at least a century, if not longer. And here in 2010, we are still treated like children. We are still treated like as if they know better than we do. And while we talk about self-determination, it's almost impossible for us to do it, because when we do become self-determining, we are called radicals, we are criminalized, and our own security is threatened. And so my question to you is, why hasn't there been a mechanism within the UN where we can call countries on their lack of respect, promotion, and preservation of human rights, especially for indigenous peoples? I mean, you all gave me some ideas, and as a representative of Aboriginal women's groups, I appreciate the presentation, but I want to tell the Member of Parliament here, and I'm glad there's at least one Member of Parliament here, that if she wants to talk to me about the issues she's asked, I would appreciate to do that. But that's my question to you all. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Carmel Kilkenny. I'm a journalist from Radio Canada International, and
Could we let the panel answer the previous question?
I guess I'll take a shot. I mean, actually, I agree with her. My sister. How can I argue with my sister? I come from a matrilineal society, so I can't argue. I'm not going to argue with the women in my society. There are limits to the United Nations, when I started my speech earlier, I talked about we couldn't get justice in a domestic situation, so we had to go take our arguments internationally, and we went to the UN. And we can't get justice in Canada, United States, so we went to the international. And when you go to the international area, there's Canada, United States there too, So we're going to one big circle, We can't get justice domestically. We get the United States to recognize all these rights, and then we try and apply it. The same two states are stopping us from applying those rights, it's just a reality that we have to live in. We have to keep in mind that the United Nations is a private club of governments, and it's not a utopian. It's not this great body of justice, peace and justice. It's not. It's a political animal, And which is a failure of the United Nations. And I think the problem with the United Nations is that it is a private club of states. What it should be is the highest body on this planet that exercises the best that humankind can be. That's a goal that I think that we all wish that the United Nations would be, but it's not. You all know that it's a it's used politically for political ends by individual states to serve their own purposes. And until that changes, until the United Nations becomes a true a body that represents humankind and that humankind can behave at the best, at the highest level that it can be, the United Nations will always be the same political animal that it is. I think that the UN can, sometime in the future, when I talk about civilization, when U.S. and Canada become to a higher civilized plane, the United Nations someday may come to a higher civilized plane where we'll all, as peoples, be able to take part. Remember, the Charter doesn't say it's nations. The Charter says peoples, And its nation states are not necessarily peoples, but because the nation states control the UN, they interpret peoples to mean states, but it's not. Right. And the United Nations should be include indigenous peoples. Indigenous peoples should have seats that because we are self-determining, and we have a voice too. We're not like trees or whales or something that can't speak. We're people that have our own voices, our own mind. And someday maybe the world will change and realize that artificial colonial borders are not really natural, and the natural world is not represented by the United Nations. And someday it will have to change its name and change its charter, etc. But maybe I'm dreaming, but I think we all have dreams and we all have aspirations. And if we don't have dreams and aspirations, then we'll fall into despair. And despair is what destroys us. So the other thing is about rights. We have to assert rights. We don't ask people. We don't ask the United Nations for rights. We didn't go there asking them for rights. We went there telling them, look, this is our rights. The same thing when we behave. We have to believe that we have these rights, and we have to exercise them, and we have to because you assert rights. You know, you don't ask for people for rights; you assert them. And indigenous people, unfortunately, when we assert them, we get killed. But that's another reality that we live in. And we're hoping that NGOs, like the young lady said earlier, and that states that do have a good conscience, and the general other people that have conscience can help indigenous peoples and other peoples who are oppressed and denied their basic human rights, that you step forward and help prevent that and support indigenous people when we do. You'll notice all the conflicts that are with indigenous people is always about land and always about the survival of indigenous people. It's about encroachment against indigenes people. That's what it's all about. You know, Chiapas, you look at, the Oka crisis, you look at, Caledonia. It's all about land. You know, Iprawash in Canada. You look at all of those conflicts that you have around the world with indigenous people. It's always about land and the survival of the people. We're always on the defensive. Indigenous peoples are not terrorists. We're not going up blowing up the Eiffel Tower, you know. We're always on the defensive, and yet we're branded terrorists, as Ellen has said, and it's wrong. It's wrong. We are the freedom fighters. You know? We're the people who are downtrodden and sometimes have to take up arms to defend our land and our territory against gold miners and loggers and whatever. You know. Anyway, we're here to talk about rights and also rights, human rights defenders, and we're hoping that. If you're listening to us, and maybe you can help defend indigenous people from while we're defending our rights, even when it comes to extreme situations. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Can I really follow up that, Ken, by saying how much I appreciate the distinction that you make between states and nations? If we go back to the beginning of the 1900s, nations meant peoples, states meant bodies that govern over particular geographic areas. Somehow the language got changed in about the 1920s, I think, when people started talking of nation states. In some cases, there was a coincidence between the people and the state, and you can legitimately use the term nation state. But when you are in a situation where you have two peoples, I think the appropriate terminology is the state, and there are two nations within the state. And that's certainly how I think Maori people see the situation, that although we do not use the terminology nation, we nonetheless see ourselves as nations in the sense that we have those inherent self-governing rights, and that these rights do not come to us by some United Nations body or the like. They are inherent in the fact that we are a people. So I really sympathize and empathize, Ken, with the views that you've expressed.
Isabel? I think a big issue in terms of when we talk about United Nations and human rights is that, and you guys mentioned this before, in the sense that, you know, the United Nations is made of governments, from government representatives, and indigenous rights have challenged the very legitimacy of these states in terms of their legitimacy to occupy the land, the legitimacy to implement all these kind of policies and so on, and that we don't necessarily see any civil society or indigenous peoples being represented in the United Nations as a to counterbalance the power of governments. And I think that's extremely problematic in pursuing rights in because we are looking at the states as being judge and part at the same time. And there are always going to be conflicts in these ways if we keep just leaving the responsibility to the states to do something at the local level. I think it would be extremely important to move away from that and to try to incorporate other representatives in a more meaningful way to counterbalance all these state powers.
Thank you. Go ahead.
First of all, excuse me, Ellen Gabriel, for my eagerness. I didn't mean to cut it off there. Three questions for each of you. First, a comment, though. I was very intrigued by what you said from New Zealand, the thinking in terms of responsibilities, not rights, and in some ways it underlines to me how young a country Canada is that we live in as the country Canada, where only now are we beginning to wrestle with our responsibilities to our elders, these aging people, many of whom came from other countries, so we have no tradition of taking care of our older people, and we have to negotiate it bit by bit in families, or, you know, maybe somewhat largely creating a collective in terms of residences, etc. But maybe we have a lot more to learn from all of you. Anyway, the questions are, I'm wondering, Kenneth Dear, what difference will it make if Canada accepts the Universal Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples? Is it just window dressing? Is it just, does it make any difference? I would like to hear a little bit more from you, Isabel, about the disappeared women. I didn't realize that this is like really a much more global reality. It's shocking enough to hear in Canada just this week that 500 women are missing, disappeared, never heard from. There was a little demonstration in Whitehorse that
Canada.
I know, but I'm saying there was a small demonstration in Whitehorse up in Yukon this week that one of the CBC carried visuals of it, and I was so astounded to see, we never see anything from Whitehorse, you know, you hardly even know it exists unless you've been there, but people are talking more and more and demanding more responsiveness on the part of missing women. So I didn't realize that it was happening at the border on the southern end of the United States. And in New Zealand, I would just like to hear a bit more about your success. Holding on to your language is huge, as people in Canada would know. It's a big issue here. And the social services, in terms of the delivery, how does that work? So one each. So
these are rather large questions, and I've been asked to call to a close soon. So
I'll be very quick. We always take the long view. I know we understand the character of the current government. It's window dressing for sure. It's obvious why. Like I said earlier, it's an insincere offer to that they will someday endorse the declaration. As Indigenous people, we're going to be here. We're here for the long haul. We've been here for centuries, and we'll be here for centuries on. The declaration will grow in importance as years go by, and that if nothing changes the day after it's endorsed, things will change in 5, 10, or 20 years from now, and that declaration will people will really see the value of that declaration in the future. And we ain't going nowhere, so we'll be around. So the sooner it's endorsed, the sooner the benefits will come.
Regarding the women that have disappeared and have been murdered, yes, this is not only happening in Canada. It is shocking enough that it's happening here. And in my view, it's also shocking that the majority of Canadians don't necessarily know about this. And I think that part of any society's responsibility in this, when we talk about these issues, is, you know, that we have to recognize that there is many other experiences of women in this country, and there are a lot of the consequences or the legacies of colonialism that continue to have an effect on the life of these women. I was part of a workshop that discussed about these issues, you know, from not just in Canada but also in Mexico and Guatemala, where Amnesty International has documented the number of cases of missing women. And one of the issues that the workshop participants were discussing is that, you know, we are calling them missing women, but maybe a better word should be taken women, because it wasn't with their consent. These women were taken with violence and disappeared with violence. And the Sisters in Spirit initiative has made a really, really wonderful working in sort of like a, you know, promoting awareness or just telling the rest of this country what is happening here. And similar initiatives have been undertaken in Guatemala and in Mexico, but there is a lot still to do. And I just would like to say that, you know, I mentioned this in my presentation, that there is a common assumption among the public that it's just prostitutes that disappear. It's just prostitutes that are taken. And this is wrong. And this is wrong when we continue to talk about that language. Because according to the Native Women Association of Canada, they did they visit and talk to different families of the taken women, and they concluded that many, yes, some of these women, you know, came from a legacy of poverty, drug addictions, and so on, some. But a lot of these women happened, just were targeted because they were Aboriginal, they were women, and, you know, because they were seen as easy targets, that nobody will care about them. And unfortunately, that's exactly what had happened. And when I am in the classroom with my Aboriginal students, I am almost concerned, always concerned that this, any of these women could have been them, you know, or could have been any of my friends. This is how serious this issue is. That some of us have started talking about feminicide, that is, you know, the atrocities or horrendous violence committed against women, and the apathy of the society in responding to this crisis, but also the government's lack of action. What Canada, Mexico, and Guatemala have all in common is that they have not taken any serious actions about this. The current government in Canada silently decided to cut off its support for the Sisters in Spirit initiative, and instead decided, well, we're going to put $10 million into changing the life of these women. $10 million to change a history of colonialism, of poverty, and exclusions is nothing. I think that's still hugely problematic, and we need to have a wider conversation about this. And I think everybody, not just Aboriginal people, not just Aboriginal women, have a responsibility to act and to solve this crisis.
Chair, before you close, I'll answer for him, if I may. I'm Donna Hall. I'd like to follow Ellen Gabriel's query that she raised. And she said she's Ken's sister. Okay, well, I'm going to claim the right to speak because I'm his wife. And in the Indigenous world, it's hard
no
to get
status
to speak closer than that. Ellen, you asked what can be done for governments that don't listen to Indigenous communities, and I heard the answers. I want to add another one to it. There are four nations that were the last to sign UNDRIP: Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and the United States. I want to suggest that we follow a model used in the Commonwealth. It's called the Pacific Forum, where governments, nations come together and meet and speak about important issues. Maybe there needs to be a Last Nations Forum that meets regularly: Canada, New Zealand, Australia, and the United States,
like Alcoholics
to address
Anonymous.
These issues. Invite you to think about that as an option, because what it does do is attract attention to the issues. If there's a broad enough coverage of countries and representation, there ought to be sponsorship, and it allows for a following on from this type of discourse: open, transparent debate.
Thank you.
So I was asked as chair to say a word in the end to try and sum up the discussion and draw out major points and so on. I just have one thing to say. A friend of mine often says to his students, to learn anything new, you need to start by unlearning. What I see coming out of this is to think anything new in the area of human rights or wherever, you have to a lot of unthinking to do, and particularly non-Indigenous people have a lot of unthinking to do. So I thank you for your assistance in some of that unthinking. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Australia, by the way, lightning. You spoke the same as you were in Australia.